You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
I'm Rebecca McEnroy with KUT Radio. Woo! And we're going to talk a lot about power and a lot about presence and what it means to mentor and be mentored and be in this space where questions of celebrity and prestige and power are all kind of coming into a very stark light right now. So here with me to discuss Sonny Rollins and the Art of Power, rabbi and jazz historian Neil Blumhoff. Welcome. So Sonny Rollins, you chose Sonny Rollins.
I did.
So let's talk a little bit about him. Who was he? When was he born? Where was he born? What is his life like?
And thank God, there still is Sonny Rollins still around. Thank God. So, has anybody ever heard him live? Anyone? Great, excellent. Well, I can't see if you're raising your hand, so. Okay. So, he was born in 1930, and he was born in New York City. Nobody? Yeah. Oh, what a crowd. And he grew up in Harlem. Right by the Apollo Theater. Actually, I lived right by the Apollo Theater. And Minton's Playhouse, laboratories where, or as jazz critics of the day called them, sort of places where jazz symposiums were being held. And his parents were immigrants from the Virgin Islands. And when he was young, he started with the piano and then the alto saxophone. He was encouraged by a guy named Louis Jordan. Okay, beautiful. And then he began playing very young with Bud Powell and Charlie Parker. And he came of age, which I think is very important in this conversation, at the end of World War II. So I think it's very important also as we talk about his incredible legacy, his seven decades plus. In 1950, when he was 20 years old, he was arrested for armed robbery. And he served 10 months in Rikers Island. And I think that's really important for us to think about as the construction of Sonny Rollins as this musician, or as was really talked about, sort of the one of the last living legacies. And if you remember, there's a famous photograph in 1958 of jazz giants in Harlem, the Day in Harlem photograph. You might want to look it up. There's only two guys left. There's only two musicians left from that photograph. Sonny Rollins is one of them. Benny Golson is the other. Yep. And so in 1952, like many in that generation, in that time, he was arrested again for heroin. However, a little earlier than many of the folks and his colleagues, in 1955, he elected to go to Boston, and he volunteered for methadone treatment to cure his addiction, and he actually did. And he broke his habit in 1955. And he began to play with some amazing musicians like Max Roach and, Clifford Brown and, Ritchie Powell. And things were going okay until Ritchie Powell and Clifford Brown died in a car wreck in 1956. And it was from there that he began to record under his own name in a very relative young age. And I think that all of this sort of rough living really crafted his character and gave him a sense of influence and how to cope and how to survive in a profession and in a world where being a young black man was and is hard.
And I want to talk a little bit before we move on to some of his mentors about his time with Max Roach and Clifford Brown. You know, like that dynamic was so fascinating, that trio, and they did things that were outside of the norm, outside of their recording contracts that they got in trouble for. But they were also really young, and they lived life differently, each of them. You know, like they came to the music differently. And talk about maybe what that dynamic a little bit was like before we move on.
Well, Sonny Rollins loved playing with Max Roach. And again, in 1955, it was only really for about a year or so, or maybe a little more. But I think the creativity that was happening in the ensemble with the amazing prodigious talents of Clifford Brown, who we've spoken about before here, and Sonny Rollins, who was, they were feeding off of each other. They were enjoying the energies of each other. And then to feel bereft and to feel that, you know, you're sort of missing someone, I think is a very important aspect of how we mourn and the traumas as we go on, how they are internalized in our life. And I was going to talk about this a little bit later, but I'm going to do it now because it's the segue to this. Just and you know, I think power has many guises about what does that mean and how we're affected in our current community and in our current culture. But I was just got back last night from I was in Atlanta at a convention. Atlanta, wow! All right. So I was in Atlanta and I had the opportunity to go by myself because I like doing stuff by myself to the new Civil Rights Museum in Atlanta. Has anybody been there? You should go. And just talking about sort of the internal sense of what we carry and how wounded we are, there's a lot to be said about that museum. And I was just saying earlier, there's a section that says children under 13 should not be part of this particular part of the exhibit. And what it is, you go in there and there's a lunch counter right there, about five or six maybe stools. And there's a young woman on duty. She works at the museum. And she said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" I'm like, "Sure, I'll do this." And it was pretty empty at the time that I went. There were a lot of uniformed soldiers and Navy folks who were there. And so there was one guy over there as well. But you put on headphones, and you put your hands on the counter, you sit on the stool, and they say, "Close your eyes." And as many museums, then, and the technology of what that sounded like, of the beginning of the hysteria of hate, of sitting at that counter and having a sit-in and then feeling so demonized. And the stool was shaking, the table was shaking. You felt like, you know, it was the next blow was going to be on your head. And the language that was being used was, and it was sort of that surround sound, so it sounded like they were circling you. And I started crying. And I don't cry, I mean, a rabbi, I don't cry very much. I hear a lot of stuff. But I started bawling. And I can only imagine, you know, when I was inculcated with the stories of the Holocaust and genocide and inhumanity to each other. And I think that to be able to be a good person or to be a best self or to strive or to have a positive sense of what the world can be, despite all of the conditioning that we get to the opposite, I think is heroic. And the fact that Sonny Rollins and others and us have the legacy of that kind of difficulty to be able to craft a meaningful life and to craft a life of good deeds or blessings or whatever you want to call it, I think is quite extraordinary. And I think the fact that he has done that and to do that in the loss of Clifford Brown or the loss of Richie Powell, who is Bud Powell's brother, is something that I think is a great lesson for all of us who are wounded, which is everyone.
And, you know, it's very interesting to me, the relationship between, you know, Clifford Brown especially was a man who, he didn't really escape to drugs. He didn't do any drugs. He was very clean. And yet he died so young, you know. And I think for this idea of where do we escape suffering, you know, how do we get away from suffering? Ignorance is a way to escape suffering. You know, it ain't got nothing to do with me. I'm not going to be a part of this, you know.
It's not my problem, not my issue.
It's not my problem. I don't want to know what it feels like. I can't believe this exists. You know, being able to step outside of that. It's one way to ignore, you know, and to claim a space of power. And I think it's something else to go under the bridge, to confront your presence and what it means to be a creator and be in a space where you have a voice, and then to say, who am I as an individual? You know, so I think that's one thing that we talked about a lot was this was his sabbatical under the bridge and what that represents. So talk a little bit about his relationship with Thelonious Monk, with Miles Davis, and then taking that sabbatical and leaving it all.
Sure. So I think that's really important, and just want to underscore what you said, that to be willfully ignorant is a luxury that not everybody has. And even though we think it's not our issue, it's certainly our issue. And I think that that's a very important lesson for all of us as we sort of think about all of them who are being affected by whatever that we think is being affected. But that's just outside our door, if not right inside our door too. So young Sonny Rollins attracted the attention of Charlie Parker, attracted the attention of Miles Davis, and later Thelonious Monk, and he began to play and he was writing some beautiful music, which we'll hear in just a moment. of really writing, and then because of his own issues that I mentioned, both because of the punishment, his arrest, and his hope to cure his drug addiction, he was sort of in and out of the scene. But he played with Miles Davis for a bit, and we're going to feature one of the tunes that he wrote, actually, called Olio. And Olio, he wrote and came out in 1954. Do you all know what Olio is?
Yes.
Margarine? You know, so it was a margarine from the 50s, yeah.
I knew what that was.
I just saw your face went like...
No, I was like, for real? That's what you're talking about right
yeah,
now?
So it's yeah, so and I think that, you know, that just kind of talks about... You can just kind of typify the 50s with Olio, maybe. Maybe not, I don't know.
No, but, I think that's a beautiful thing to do, to go to food.
So once he, you know, once he stepped out, John Coltrane picked it up too, and there's various recordings of him playing. But it's a beautiful tune, but it uses the chord changes of George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, which many tunes did in this period. And the debut, as I said, features John Coltrane. And this nexus between, or among, actually, John Coltrane, later Ornette Coleman, and Sonny Rollins is very, very interesting. And I think there's a lot of work to be done about thinking about all of that, which we'll get to. And then his work in 1956, it was a very busy year for him, those mid-50s, Bemsha Swing, which was written by Thelonious Monk and a guy named Denzil Best. Yep. And give it up for drummers, everybody. Love that. So the drummer, Denzil Best, who was a drummer. So Bemsha Swing, or Bemsha Swing, is a respelling of Bimshire, which is a nickname of Barbados, which was Best's family home. A little Barbados going on here?
Yeah.
All right, beautiful. So I think this whole... Caribbean, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we picked Bemsha Swing as well, is this sort of Caribbean connection and this immigrant connection of recognizing that, you know, who are we in this world but just passing through? And I think jazz in many ways is so American, and yet it's there's so many various aspects, like you're holding your identity of Americans like a diamond in the light to see the various carats of who and what we are and the various ways it refracts. So I think that that's really important. So Olio and Bemsha Swing we picked because we wanted to show his connection and his mentorship and his guidance and his grounding with Miles Davis, who was dealing with his own drug addiction, and Thelonious Monk, who was Thelonious Monk.
You know. And then we're going to introduce our musicians right now. But but before we do, I was just listening to this interview with Adrienne Rich this morning, and... She mentioned, since you brought up diamonds, what diamonds are coal, you know, and before that they were dust and people, you know? And she has this beautiful poem about, like, you know, when you embrace a diamond.
I'm going to start crying
and
again.
I know, right? I'm not going to, first of all, like, say all diamonds are good because they're not, of course. But there's something about, you know, valuing this diamond, but then also knowing, like, it used to be someone who someone else loved, you know, and now it's being exchanged out of love. So I think it's really kind of a beautiful thing to bring that up.
Nice. I feel the same way when I fill up my car. I do. I really... I gotta go. What am I going to... What are you going to do? So we're going to hear Olio and Bemsha Swing as sort of grounding and contextualizing Sonny Rollins. Then we'll get to some of his more individualistic compositions. But we'd love to introduce these wonderful musicians who are here. So coming all the way from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam. He heard about our jazz series, Views and Brews, and he's like, I'm coming. Our dear friend and Austin's own, Alex Koch. And a Views and Brews debut, playing trumpet, you'll love him. His name is Derek Becker. Beautiful. Coming back after some wonderful time touring and making some music elsewhere, love his sound, is Mr. Sean Giddings. And so glad and blessed. He's a drummer, by the way. So blessed to have Brandon Temple here tonight, everybody. And perhaps the dean of music in many ways, and we're so glad to have him here, and with his open heart and his just willingness and generosity, the bassist, Roscoe Beck.
Thank you. Brennan Temple on drums. Roscoe Beck on bass. Sean Giddings on piano. Derek Becker on trumpet. And Alex Koch on saxophone.
So as we show sort of the grounding of Sonny Rollins in the beautiful au revoir of Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk, that was a composition. The first one, Olio, is a composition that Sonny Rollins himself wrote. And really reflective of some of the hard bop influences of the very late 40s and early 50s and mid 50s as well. So hope that you got steeped in a little bit of that. And if you'd like that Bemsha swing, that was really beautiful, gentlemen. You can check out the version Brilliant Corners from the late 50s, 1959. That was where Sonny Rollins joins Thelonious on that tune.
Yeah. And I would like to mention, too, Alex Koch has CDs outside to sell, so make sure that you pick one up on your way. CDs and albums, I think. Actual vinyl.
Nice.
That's exciting. Oh,
very yeah. Nice.
But, you know, I want to talk a little bit about what it meant to Sonny Rollins to be from the West Indies. Like, what was his relationship to the West Indies, and how did he carry that through his process of becoming himself?
You know, it's a great question. And, you know, it's easy just to sort of slip into this, which we're going to feature in a moment, which the composition of St. Thomas, which is where he was from. It is the Bemsha Suite, highlighting Barbados, which is sort of in the southern part of the Caribbean, St. Thomas right next to Puerto Rico in the northern part. And there's not much, I mean, I think there's a lot more to be said is what I'm trying to say, that one can sort of begin the conversation with, oh, St. Thomas, that was a nursery song that his mom used to sing to him. And then he remembered it and he sort of made it this beautiful, perhaps his most well-known tune, this Calypso tune. And that's something that one can think about. But I think just in terms of other, you know, even among the gradations of who's accepted and what's accepted. I mean, we've talked about this a little bit with Charles Mingus. But even among, you know, folks that you might want to sort of, you know, classify as white or as African-American or as whatever, you know, there's maybe a hint that maybe Sonny Rollins perhaps realized, too, that there was something a little bit different about him because of where he was from also.
Yeah, and it's a very complicated relationship to also understand that, you know, what you're a part of and who your parents are might, you know, what parts do you want to hold on to of that story and what parts do you want to kind of, you know, make them become the darkness. So that's it's an interesting process, especially for the way that he understood his role as an American and what that meant as part of his journey.
Right, and finding his way from his rough youth into playing with, you know, Thelonious Monk, Miles Davis, just a few years, Max Roach, just a few years later, is really quite extraordinary. And how many of us here have parents who are immigrants to this country? How many of you have parents who were forced to come to this country? So the understanding that, you know, the otherness that we might carry and the languages that we might speak, or the different kinds of experiences that we have, again, land us in this sort of syncopation of culture. And I think that's beautifully American, but it can also be very difficult to navigate as well.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, his role as an innovator and what that meant to him. You know, how did he see himself as an innovator, and how did he see that process as actually part of what he was doing?
Well, I think that he found his voice, again, writing these sort of hard bop tunes. Doxy is another one. And then in the mid-50s, I think he found his... This is me. I think he found his voice. I think he found his voice with compositions like St. Thomas and the next tune that we'll feature after that called Freedom Suite, where he began to sort of synthesize all of his experiences and bring them to forward into being who and what he was. And then, his connections with Ornette Coleman, and then with the launch of Giant Steps by John Coltrane, I think it kind of, you know, made him regard himself differently, like, who am I and what am I? I don't know about you, but sometimes when I feel that I've done something really great and then realize all the great people out there, I'm kind of like, that's, wow.
I'll let you know after. Well, looking after I do something great.
Well, looking in the mirror, and I think that what you're leading up to is that I think in 1959, after his connections with Ornette and with Coltrane, that he went on sabbatical. He's like, I'm going to have to figure myself out a little bit. I'm doing great, and it's not harmonious or whole. And from 1959 to 1961, he was living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Anybody? They used to have really good delis there. What are you going to do? It's sad. But then, so he's living in the apartment, and he's playing a saxophone, and a woman has a baby. And to be considerate of her and her family, he goes on top of the Williamsburg Bridge. And for a very long time, every day, starts playing on the bridge. And he wasn't recording. He wasn't sort of seeking out. And I think that that's a really remarkable sense of self-realization, that one can recognize that it's time to stop or to time to fill up differently. And I think that, and we're talking about power, I think this understanding that Alfred Lord Tennyson, anybody? Okay, well, whatever. He says this, and I think this really fits. I don't know, whatever. he says, you know, you got to do your thing. He says this. He says, self-reverence, self-knowledge, and self-control. These three alone lead one to sovereign power. And I think the fact that he had those, and then he was able to recognize that he didn't have to just keep doing the thing or just keep, you know, on the what's the thing called in the spin wheel? What's that thing? Treadmill, right? I don't know. I don't know. It's exercise. I've heard of it. So it's just being on the treadmill, you know, you can recognize that you can stop. How many of you would like to take maybe like a year and just kind of check it out and see what's up? All right. So let's follow Sonny Rollins' example. Tomorrow morning, you go into where you need to go and say, I am inspired by Sonny Rollins, and I'm going to go stand on the bridge and play for the bats.
I mean, let's not underestimate or undervalue his support system during this time also. You know, I mean, his wife was supporting him. His wife was supporting him financially. He was also being supported by his residuals, like what he'd recorded a lot. And later on in his life, in about the 60s and 70s, he did this wonderful documentary with the BBC where he said, I could have just stayed. You know, I could have just played because the public doesn't care. As long as I play good, like, they don't really care. Like, my real journey is to find out who I am, you know, and then to, like, bring to my music, like, who I am as an individual and what that means. And the process of leaving behind that image of, you know, I have access to prestige, I have access to power, I have access to all of this, but I have no idea who I am. Like, that is a brave thing to do, to leave that behind. And he could really only do it because he was supported by that previous life and by his wife.
So preach, McEnroy. There you go. I love it.
I'll cut that out of the podcast. I'll just ask you a question. Easy. No, I'm just kidding. But
right.
You know what
so
I mean? I mean, we have to
residuals.
Acknowledge that.
We just have to get residuals and family who can support us.
Well, all I'm saying is, like, there are some lives that we need to lead in order to be, you know, and to have kind of the foundation to become who we're really going to become.
For sure. However, I agree. And I think that all of us who maybe don't have that foundation and don't have that luxury, don't have that life, can still find bursts of ways to fill up or have sabbaticals or, for some of you, Shabbat. But the other understanding, you know, but the understanding, you know, I'm just saying. But the understanding of that we don't just have to feel that we're just going to be worked to the bone. I know so many people, maybe you do too, who've worked a beautiful, successful career, retire, and then die within the year. Do you know folks like that? So just the understanding that we train ourselves to not be understanding of who we are, and I agree with you, but even if we don't have that capability to stand on the Williamsburg Bridge, that we can still find ways to not perform, if you understand what I mean.
That's a beautiful thing. So are we going to hear another tune?
A couple, actually.
Let's hear them.
So, by the way, he said in this sabbatical, if you're thinking about what to do, not only did he play, he also took up yoga. He's, you know what? How old is he now? 87? So yoga. I'm just saying. You don't roll your eyes. I can see you from here. Okay? So So what he said, so he had just gone to Europe. He had just released beautiful albums. But I really think that he was thinking about Ornette, and he was thinking about John Coltrane, and he was thinking about his life and sort of like, where am I and who am I and where do I fit in? And even though I'm all that, as you said, you know, how, what's it all worth? You know, the legacy. What's my legacy? What's my importance here? And how much of this is just disposable? How much of it is just entertainment? So he said in 1961, he said, I could have probably spent the rest of my life just going up on the bridge. I realized, no, I have to get back into the real world. And it's actually an interesting story of how he did. There was a reporter passing by one day who heard him, and he did a story about him, and that sort of brought him back into the world, for better or for worse. So we're going to hear two tunes, St. Thomas.
You know, before that, you know, what he said also is that he wanted to communicate. Like, he wanted to communicate. He wanted to be heard. So there was playing to play, but there's also playing to resonate and to have that conversation, which is a different process.
Agreed. So, and I think that the fact that you're playing from the inside, and it's so great to be able to do this in public, but, you know, how much of this would just, you know, resonate differently if we were by ourselves, and how much are we sharing our own energies? And that's a great quote from David Hume, the philosopher, who said, the heights of popularity and patriotism are still the beaten road to power and tyranny. So I'm just put that in your pipe and smoke it. So just saying. So the two tunes that we're going to hear, one from 1956 called St. Thomas. It's from the album called Saxophone Colossus, right? And it's a calypso tune sung by his mother. However, if you look at it, which I have done, because I just sit around all day thinking about all this stuff, you know, okay, is it actually comes from a traditional English song, which is the Lincolnshire Poacher. And you look that, I listened to that about four times in the last couple of weeks, and wow.
And
there we go. Let's do it. Open that door. Open that door, Rebecca.
Let's not discard the relationship between the West Indies and England.
For sure. You know. Go ahead.
Which is a big deal, I think.
He was able to improvise on rhythmic patterns instead of melodies and changes. And I think that that's a very, very important aspect of things. The second thing is a tune that he wrote called Freedom Suite. Comes out in 1958. And it's an extended composition for tenor saxophone. And it's a partnership in playing that you'll hear with our ensemble. Beautiful ensemble. Aren't they amazing? And he writes, he calls it his theme and variations, just like you would a Mozart or anything else. And here's his quote. This is Sonny Rollins speaking. He says, how ironic, and this is 1958, how ironic that the Negro, who more than any other people can claim America's culture as his own, is being persecuted and repressed. That the Negro, who has exemplified the humanities in his very existence, is being rewarded with inhumanity. So I think that he was writing that after Brown versus the Board of Education. He's writing that in 1958, which is the scar, actually it's not even scars, the open wounds that are still part of our society. And I think that that's a very important thing that doesn't get played very much, and because it's 19 minutes, but we're not going to do the long version. But Whitney Bailett, who is a music critic for The New Yorker, writes, his immensely long solos seem paradoxically like endless strings of epigrams. And we're going to hear these two tunes. And after he came off the sabbatical, he'd had a tremendously adventurous life, which we'll talk about also. But I think these two tunes really accentuate his finding his voice. And I hope that we continue to find our voice as we realize we don't have to necessarily perform every day. So we welcome back up our ensemble, yes? For the two tunes, St. Thomas and Freedom Suite.